I think some of the criticism Canadians have about other Canadians is the lack of outward patriotism. I think we look at our neighbors down south, see the flag-waving pomp they attach to their pride, and there's a knee-jerk impulse to distance ourselves from it. We like to think that we're more reserved than our American counterparts. In fact, that's what we take pride in. Also, I think it's still subconscious residue from being under British rule and the stiff upper lip that came with it. Interpret as you will, but the inevitable fallout is a lack of recognition to deserving parties, especially when it comes to the arts. The idea that one never gets recognized by their own until outside acknowledgement is achieved is never more true than within Canada. There is a long list of sons and daughters who traded in their Canadian aspirations for American ones. Even our band, we had to leave Canada and journey abroad to achieve our modicum of success. But as my adventures have taken me farther and farther away from home, I've noticed a wistful urge for all things Canadian. No more is it noticeable than when someone on tour mentions a Canadian band we all know. Even a band as popular as Rush can generate a conversation emanating from homesickness. When you tour the world, you quickly realize every country has their own music scene and their own list of top-shelf homegrown bands, but often are never able to break internationally. Given that rock music's greatest sources have been from America and the UK, it's been frustrating for Canadian bands, who share so much culturally, but hardly gain the same amount of recognition. Growing up watching these great Canadian bands relegated to regional popularity has been both demoralizing and motivating. The bright side was, as a rock fan in Canada, we were exposed to every American and UK act along with the rich, deserving parade of Canadian bands. It was almost like a countrywide secret how good they were, but unfortunately, due to a mixture of factors, most were never known outside of Canada. Bands like Chilliwack, FM, Toronto, Harlequin, Max Webster, Honeymoon Suite, Platinum Blonde, Blue Rodeo, the Northern Pikes, the Headpins, the Spoons, and hundreds more sat side by side on the same level with the great international bands of the day when we Canadian kids would listen to the radio or visit record stores. I couldn't tell the difference between whether Gowan was from London, England, or Toronto, Ontario. And FYI, he's from Toronto, Scarborough, in fact, and sings for Styx now. But that's another story for another podcast episode. My point is, as these international bands have simmered into middle age, the accolades, nostalgic revisits, and renewed admiration hasn't wavered. Some bands have even enjoyed second and third waves of popularity that have surpassed their initial glory. But where does it leave their Canadian counterparts? Again, our national tendency is to skirt away from ostentatious displays of retro glory, which in turn make it difficult for deserving legends to appreciate being appreciated. That is why I was so impressed when I found out about the rock band Took. Took is a quartet comprised of top-level A1 Canadian musicians who have achieved success internationally, near legendary in their own right, and have banded together to pay tribute to the Canadian rock bands that we as Canadian rocker kids all grew up listening to. Took's lineup reads like an all-star group of ringers. Shane Gallus on drums, who has played with Michael Schenker, Yngwie Malmsteen, Uli John Roth, Vinnie Moore, and Japan's legendary Bees. Corey Churko on lead guitar has worked with Shania Twain, Kelly Clarkson, Reba McEntire, Mutt Lange, and Slash. Brent Fitz on bass guitar and drums has drummed for Alice Cooper, Theory of a Dead Man, Jakey Lee, The Guess Who, Gene Simmons, and currently plays drums with Slash, featuring Miles Kennedy and the Conspirators, and of course, Todd Kearns on vocals and guitar, who fronted the legendary rock band Age of Electric and also the legendary rock band Static and Stereo. He currently plays with Bob and Bruce Kulick and, of course, with Brent Fitz in Slash's band featuring Miles Kennedy and the Conspirators on bass guitar. Last year, Todd received a star on the BC Entertainment Walk of Fame. I mean, The man is the man. And Took is the band. They've released two albums so far of Canadian rock covers, 2016's Giver and this year's Never Enough, that also includes their first original song, Never Enough for You. Both albums are so good, but I can't rave enough how close the recordings are to the originals. One can hear the labor of love involved in the recordings and how much it means to all the members. The selection of songs are choice too, like Aldenova's Fantasy, On the Loose by Saga, Roller by April Wine, New Girl Now by Honeymoon Suite, The Spirit of Radio by Rush, Lunatic Fringe by Red Rider, and Don't It Make You Feel by the Headpins, just to name a few. For anyone who grew up listening to Canadian rock radio, subjected to SOCAN regulations, will know most, if not all, the songs on both Took albums. They're reminders of just how rich and credible Canada was when it came to hard rock music. Took is homegrown validation for bands whose accolades are overdue. One listen, and I guarantee it'll get fans hunting to rebuy the old albums. I asked Todd Kearns to jump on the podcast and talk about all things Took with me, and he thankfully obliged. It's not every day I get to throw out band names like Harlequin, Queen City Kids, and Chilliwack with somebody, so it was cool to talk to a kindred rocker. I want to point out here that the Osmonds song I couldn't remember during the episode is actually called Hold Her Tight, not Let Her Know. Doesn't make sense now, but listen to the episode and you'll get what I mean. Todd being on this episode means he joins a select group of guests that have been on both my podcasts, Damien Abraham, Derek Green, Don Jameson, Nick Sewell, Nick Flanagan, and now Todd Kearns have all been on both the official Danko Jones podcast and the Regal Beagle podcast, my other podcast focusing on the 70s sitcom Three's Company. Anyways, without further ado, Todd Kearns is this episode's guest on the official Danko Jones podcast, and it starts now. The Danko Jones podcast is the best around. Nick Flanagan is Danko's go out to for free. I'm so glad I do sometimes. Damn it, from fucked up. Stop playing. Hang down, down. When the weather is bad and there's nothing much to do, take a listen, would you now, to what Danko Jones would do. It's the middle of the night and you better do it fast. Turn the speakers up loud for Danko's podcast.
Ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, get ready because the Danko Jones podcast starts. No!
Hey, Todd.
How are you?
I'm good, man. How are you? How's everything at home?
Great, great. It's good to be home, actually. It's been, you know, as you know, when you're away for as long as guys like you and me go away, it's always nice to come home. We went to see Donnie and Marie last night, which was...
Oh, man.
It was super crazy, dude. I'm like, you know, because it's like, yeah, that sounds like fun. Like, I, you know, just kind of got some tickets through friends of ours, and I'm like, and you get there and you're like, oh, wow, that's Donnie and Marie.
It's like, yeah.
You know, like the TV show, we were kids and all that. I'm like, damn, that's really crazy. But it was fun for what it was. It was super cheesy and super corny and super Vegas, but it was, and pretty Mormon, I suppose, but it was pretty, but it was, it was pretty fun.
Yeah. When we were in Vegas, back in February, there was an ad for their show. And
right.
Marie Osmond was playing the wildest looking electric guitar. Did you see that?
Yeah, it's this crazy custom made headless thing, and it's shaped like an M,
yeah.
Like as in Marie, and it's like all bedazzled. So it's super crazy. Yeah, it's she played it last night. It's kind of her thing, I guess. I think a dude out here might have built it. I forget his name now. He passed away since, but there was a guitar, or Ed Roman was his name. I'm gonna Google that right now while I'm talking to you, and I'll send it to you if I find it.
Yeah.
Because everybody talks about that guitar. Like, what guitar is that, man? I go, I don't know.
Yeah, because the Osmonds, I always feel, were the greatest rock band that never was.
It's a bizarre parallel. I mean, like, I was thinking about it the other day, how the Jacksons and the Osmonds have this very similar, you know, how like the youngest brother and daughter were like sort of the mainstays of the I guess the most successful. and in Michael and Janet and in Marie and Donnie. And it's like, but there's a whole other chapter of like, of the Jacksons, and there's a whole other chapter of the Osmonds that's actually fucking rad that no one, it kind of gets overlooked, unfortunately.
Yeah. I love Crazy Horses.
Oh, dude. Yeah. They played it last night, or he played it. He sang it last night.
Oh, my God. Yeah. I mean,
that song is the shit. I played it with Ginger Wildheart one time. We got up and jammed it with his band, Frank and I. I'm just sending you this this little article about that guitar right now.
Oh, amazing. Yeah, because I always think, wow, what a loss, you know, that they decided to not pursue this rock avenue because of, you know, their religious beliefs. But it's,
is that what it was?
Yeah, that's what I read. I heard, especially Crazy Horses, people accuse them of taking drugs, you know, horse.
Uh-huh. And yeah, sure. So yeah. I always wondered what that was in. I mean, was it a Native American thing?
They said it was about cars, like race cars.
Interesting. Okay, yeah, there you go. Sure. I mean, from their perspective, a bunch of clean, you know, religious people, I'm sure it was like, yeah, it was just crazy horses, you know. But that song is crazy. Like, whenever you hear it, you're like, damn, dude, this song rocks.
Yeah, yeah. And there's another song off that same album, too. I cannot remember. The opening cut, Let Her Know, I think it's called. It's
okay.
It's a, like, Bonham-esque drumming. I'm just like, what the hell?
Are those like session dudes on those records?
No, it's the brothers.
Yeah, because they could have, like, I can't remember which one played drums, but I was doing a drum solo on something I was watching, and I was going, damn, I had no idea this could play like this.
Yeah.
The whole band is like, you know, the, what's his name, plays that guitar solo in Crazy Horses. It's a really cool guitar solo.
I don't know the brothers' names except for Donnie, but they all look, I mean, we've all seen the video. They all look like they're playing it, you know?
Yeah, they do, yeah. Wow. And they all look bizarrely like different, slightly different clones of each other.
Yeah, totally.
Even Marie, like, it's this bizarre, like, which one is that now? You're like,
yeah. Oh. Yeah, one's like the shaggy version of the clone, and one's the clean-cut version of the clone.
Yeah. One's taller, one's shorter, one's a little... Yeah, totally.
Well, Todd, I mean, I got you here today because, first of all, you were on the Regal Beagle podcast, and you joined an elite group made up, I think, of only five other people who have been on both.
Wow. Yeah. There you go. That's, what an honor.
Yeah. I believe it is an honor. I think it is an honor.
I will take it as such, for sure.
Yeah. Mainly because, you know, Took have released their second album. You know, Took is your band with Brent Fitz and Corey Chirkos and Shane Gillis. Yeah. And it's, I mean, you guys are ambassadors for Canadian hard rock. And I think every new Canadian, there should be a Took CD that comes with the citizenship.
Right.
And I love it because I love... I have to admit, I love most of these songs. These are Western Canada-oriented track listings for the most part.
It really is, actually. It's funny that you say that because not only is it generational, it's also regional. You know what I mean? Like, it's like when people ask us, so what made you choose these songs? And I go, well, it's the songs we grew up on. And it's specifically three guys from the prairies, four guys from three different prairies, sorry. talking about like the different music we grew up on, and which is largely West Coast or Western Canadian, the prairies based music, you know. So yeah, we do have a tendency to kind of like, not necessarily overlook, but we sort of like favor, you know. Obviously, we're more than aware. I'd love to hear your thoughts on you know, some of the other stuff we should be touching. But there's a great many things like Triumph we have completely overlooked.
No, did you do Roller, right?
Well, that's an April Wine, yeah.
Oh,
yeah.
That's April Wine. Sorry. Yeah, you're right. Yeah. You should do Triumph. My God.
I know. I can't believe we haven't yet. And it's funny because we went through this entire process and the first time we did it, and then the second time we did it, it was like, yeah, let's do that. That'll be fun. That'll be great. And the next thing you know, you're kind of at the end of it going, we didn't do Triumph again. like, whoops. But I mean, it's kind of a good problem to have. And I kind of look at it as like, that's how much music we love from Canada, you know what I mean? It's only scratching the surface, as you can imagine. I mean, if you had to sit down right now and Danko Jones was going to make a a Canadian tribute record, like just of your favorites, I'm sure it would be awesomely diverse.
Or it can be Took EC.
There you go.
East Coast.
East
Coast Took.
Well, we do like I say, like there's April Wine, there's
Platinum Blonde,
Rush,
yeah,
Honeymoon Sweet. So I mean, it's so funny because you know, it is a very sort of specific thing. Like for us, it's sort of like very much the music that a lot of us started off playing in clubs, you know, when we were like teenagers, and bands like Platinum Blonde or Honeymoon Sweet or Haywire or all these bands that were huge at the time were bands that we had to cover, you know. So it was kind of like when we would get together and knock ideas around, it was kind of like, wouldn't it be hilarious to do, you know, this or that, you know, and surprising how much of that stuff is still in your DNA. Like I usually remember how to play them and the words, which is something I forget immediately now, but for some reason I can tell you all the words to like New Girl now, no problem.
Right. Well, out on the West Coast, you know, back in the day, I mean, you guys cut your teeth on the cover band circuit, am I right?
Absolutely, yeah.
Yeah, and I think that only makes good musicians. I mean, look at the Beatles, look at Metallica. These guys became as good as they did because they played covers, you know.
Yeah, I refer to it as our Hamburg years, you know. It's a,
right, yeah.
The Beatles is the best example, and the Stones, too, because I mean, like the Stones and the Yardbirds all started off playing their favorite blues songs and then sort of morphed into their own thing. And the Beatles would do, you know, they went off to Hamburg and did like six sets a night or whatever it was, some crazy amount of time. Mm-hmm. And they were doing all Chuck Berry and Little Richard and all their favorite songs. And it really does sort of prepare you, you know, like you just become so accustomed to being on stage playing in front of people, which I think is half the battle. I mean, you as a performer know as well, it's, you know, it's one thing to be playing in your basement. It's another thing to just suddenly get up in front of people and you know, and become comfortable at that. And we were comfortable at it before we ever started, you know, playing our own music, so that it became very natural just to kind of, to be honest, to this day, I feel more comfortable on stage than I do in any social setting.
Oh, my God. I totally agree with you on that.
It's like, let's get together for this dinner party. You're like, oh, God, do I have to prepare material? I don't know what, you know, I don't know what to do.
Yeah, suddenly it's a high school dance. I just want to sink into the wall again.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, unless I can DJ it, I don't want to be there.
Right, the DJ. Yeah, exactly. But the one thing, first of all, my introduction to Took didn't come from you. It came from Garth Richardson.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, we were recording our last record, Rock Supreme, with Garth at his studio. And I don't know, your name came up and he goes, have you heard Took? And then I went on Spotify and I got a listen to the whole album. And I think I tweeted you right away. I was blown away by the whole album, mainly because it is so, I mean, so spot on. Anyone who is versed in Canadian hard rock music, you got to listen to Took's albums, because it's not so much anyone can do like the song, but it's also like the keyboards and intros to some of these songs, like the Alda Nova one and the Red Rider one.
I mean, yeah, that's right.
Holy cow. Like it's almost as if you guys, you know, trolled the internet and figured out exactly what, you know, pedal, what gauge of strings these guys used, and you recreated it to a T.
It's so funny because I remember like Ralph James, you know, the agent, he was the bass player for Harlequin, and he came and saw us play once, and he comes up, he goes, you guys are nuts. You guys learned the mistakes.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Oh.
And it was one of those things that, you know, like Corey Churko, predominantly it's like his lab that we're sort of creating this in, because he's got his own studio and we go over there and he's sitting there like just painstakingly going over, does this sound more like the right keyboard patch than this? And I'm like, because I'm from that school of like, you know, we've all been in bands where we've covered songs and you just do a Danko Jones version of that song or an Age of Electric version of that song or whatever it is. You just kind of like, yeah, there's a keyboard, but we don't have a keyboard player, so we just play it like this, you know?
Yeah.
And with Took, it became this sort of like, it became like a curator's job of like, because here's where it gets really interesting. Because to me, it's like, without waving a flag too much or getting too serious about it. But it really was kind of like this music that we loved and grew up on, bands like the Queen City Kids that may not have even been familiar with, you may not have been familiar with back east, I'm not sure. But they were from Regina, Saskatchewan, and were like heroes to us. And they had a great song called Dance, and we do one of this new record called Down Again. Just a great Cheap Trick kind of rock band, you know what I mean? When we started to kind of record these songs, Corey was really sort of like, look, there's a lot of people who've never heard these songs before. And, you know, it was sort of like, if it's somebody in Australia or South America or Japan, you know, that's the exciting part, is when someone from those areas goes, this is my favorite song you guys do. And you go, wow, dude, they never would have heard this song had we not recorded it, because it just didn't have the opportunity to reach that far. You know what I mean? And again, I'm saying reach that far generationally and geographically, because there's a lot of people who are too young to be aware of that music, and they just not from Canada. So, as you know, Canadian classic rock radio is totally different than anywhere else in the world, because we can listen to the classic rock radio and hear April Wine and Harlequin and groups like that. But it's not like that everywhere. So, yeah, Corey really kind of, like, I mean, literally, like, he's doing the guitar solo for My Girl, Gone, 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 the Chilliwack song, and he's like, I think this tone is closer. And I'm kind of like, dude, you could play it, you know, in whatever form, and it'd be awesome. But he's like, he's that kind of pseudo-religious about it, in a sense, you know? So a lot of that credit has to go to him. As a friend of mine, actually, he's like, dude, I can't remember what song he was talking about, like Saga or something like that. He goes, it sounds like it's your voice singing to the Saga track.
Yeah, it does, especially that track. It's
Corey
crazy.
He's one of those guitar players that can kind of do that kind of guitar playing and nail it, you know what I mean? So, which is not my school at all, but he's, you know, he's so good at that kind of thing.
I'm so impatient in the studio, and to really zero in on like a keyboard sound or a guitar tone, I lose perspective very quickly. I don't even know now.
You know? I'm the same way. Apparently, yeah. Prince was fairly go. Like, you would, this is what I'm sort of told. I'm sure he was probably, you know, because he was Prince, he was probably anal in many ways. But I've heard he was pretty sort of like plug the guitar in, you know, da 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 da, and off he would go. So
I have heard that too.
I understand that kind of mentality more than the kind of like, let's sort of listen to this snare drum for, you know, 3 days. Yeah. You know, that stuff sort of kills my creativity. But why you have other people to do that. You know what I mean? My job is to show up and scream and yell and make a racket and then have somebody turn that into something, you know?
Yeah, exactly. It's funny you mentioned the Queen City Kids, because I worked at a music store, a record store, a few years back, long time ago, actually. And my manager was the brother of John Donnelly of Queen City Kids.
Yeah, there's Donnellys all across the country.
Across the country. So Tom was my manager.
Tom Donnelly. Okay, wow.
And when I went out west, we played a show with a bunch of bands in BC one day. And there's this guy walking around who looks exactly like Tom Donnelly. And so I go up to him and I go, are you related to Tom Donnelly? He goes, I'm John Donnelly.
Hilarious.
And so we called up Tom. And ever since then, you know, whenever I see John Donnelly, almost more than Tom Donnelly, when we go out west, Tom moved back to Regina. And John, when I've seen him, it's been in BC. And yeah, it's kind of this crazy thing with Queen City Kids and us.
Oh, that's so cool. Yeah, honestly, I was telling this story the other day, how when I was like about 13, 14 years old, I was in Saskatoon. I lived in a town outside of Saskatoon. So Saskatoon was like the big city. It was a big deal to go in and go to a mall and see a 7-Eleven. It was like street lights, you know, like the normal things that, you know, people take for granted. But I was like, oh, my God. And I remember Alex Chowacki, the lead singer, was walking down Second Avenue because they were playing at a place called the A4, which was a big club back then in Saskatoon. One of the, you know, mainstays of where you would, if you were touring across the prairies, you always stopped at that club. And, you know, me and my friend, the guitar player that I would jam with, we were like jogging down the street to get his autograph and stuff, you know, and it's like so funny to think, like, you know, and I've gotten to know those guys as, you know, as adults, and it's just a fascinating, because to us, and this is, I think you could probably attest to this as well, because of the way Canadian content in Canada with the radio works, to us, it didn't matter if a band was from Regina or Winnipeg or Toronto or from London, England or Los Angeles.
Yeah.
They were all on the radio. They were all influences on us. You know what I mean? And, and it's funny because even when we're recording, say with Slash, Brent Fitz and I will both be talking about, you know, that part in that one Streetheart song? Let's do that in this part here. You know what I mean? And it's like references that no one would know what the hell we're talking about except for some guys from our part of the world and our generation. So, I mean, the Canadian music still to this day, I mean, the output and content that's coming it has a major influence on us as young Canadians all the way across the board.
Oh, yeah. I mean, if Slash was in a room right beside Mark Holmes of Platinum Blonde, everybody would be going, "That's Slash." I'd be, "Yeah, but he's standing beside Mark Holmes."
That's absolutely, because it all depends on where you're from. And it's funny because I talk to friends back home and they'll be talking about, because I don't live in Canada anymore. So they'll be talking about Canadian artists that I don't know anymore, like, you know, newer artists. And I'm like, "Oh, wow, I gotta brush up because I don't know what the hell you're talking about."
Right.
But I mean, we've been very lucky to have like yourself and Monster Truck and a bunch of other groups that, you know, we've sort of chased down and followed up on over the years. And but yeah, it's the stuff we grew up on, and that's why the focus for Took is always sort of like, you know, oh, you know, Red Rider and, you know, like all that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
I keep trying to shove Eyes of a Stranger by Paola's in there, and you know, it hasn't quite made it to the top of the list yet. But
what? I love that song.
That's one of my faves, actually. Bob Rock, the producer, of course, was in a band called the Paolas with Paul Hyde. They later went on to be called Rock and Hyde.
Mm-hmm.
I think the term Paola was controversial.
It screwed them. Yeah.
Yeah, I think it was. Although it was an amazing name, really, when you actually know what it is.
Yeah.
But
yeah. There's so many. I mean, I actually did a little list here that I was going to throw you some names because we kind of both agreed that the Took playlist is kind of West Coast centric.
It is. Yes. Admittedly so. Yes.
Yeah. I was wondering if, you know, you had heard of like Streetheart over here, at least growing up in Toronto. I knew the band, but it seems like Streetheart was like huge out West.
Oh yeah. They were gods out West. Yeah.
Yeah. I don't know if it was the same out East, although we all know who Streetheart are.
Sure. Yeah.
But then there's other bands like the Jitters. Do you remember them?
Of course. Yeah. I remember the Jitters. Yeah.
National Velvet.
National Velvet. Yeah.
Of course.
National Velvet in Calgary, like back in the 90s, maybe.
Yeah. Yeah.
They're great.
There's like, of course, there's a few BC bands like Grapes of Wrath, Doug and the Slugs.
Oh, yeah,
Marth
yeah.
and the Muffins. There's so many that I guess more albums. Yeah.
Marth and the Muffins, was that Echo Park?
Echo Beach. Yeah, Echo Beach.
Great song. That's a great song.
Yeah.
See, we talk about all those things get tossed around. Rough Trade,
Crimes of Passion. Yeah.
Crimes of Passion, you know, No Contact. I mean, there's a lot of great songs, you know. So it's always tough to because then you go like Rockin' in the Free World, Neil Young, and you go, well, yeah, it's Canadian, but it's such an international song. You kind of feel like it's sort of like, I mean, obviously playing it live is a blast, but sort of committed to tape, even though the first record we had, like Working for the Weekend and Roller and those sort of, which are largely, even Fantasy by Alda Nova is largely a international hit. Like when, you know, I have a lot of American friends who will be like, oh, I know this song. And I'm always kind of surprised, you know, like, I guess we're pretty international songs. But then, you know, like you say, like Harlequin or although Harlequin was produced, their first album, I think their first few albums were produced by Jack Douglas.
Oh.
Jack did Aerosmith and John Lennon. And so we've run into him on a few occasions and we always blow his mind when, you know, he's, you know, because he has this catalog of, you know, legendary stuff. And we immediately go into like Crimes of Passion, Harlequin. And he always looks at me like, what? And of course he has amazing things. He's like, I love that, you know, that stuff. And I love those guys. They had such promise. It's an interesting thing because we all grew up on so many bands that should have been huge, you know, or should have been internationally huge.
Yeah.
Sort of the nature of the beast.
Well, so when I was a kid, I used to go to open skates. Very Canadian.
Okay, yeah.
you know, and just and just skate around on like Saturday or Sunday mornings and afternoons. And they'd be like
the Stroke, Billy Squire, you know, all that
and
kind of stuff.
They used to play like the Saga and Toronto and all those bands. Walking around listening to Took on my headphones, I was able to conjure those feelings up, and I said, you know, that is how strict you guys stuck to the script in terms of just how close the recordings are to the originals. They're really good, and it's absolutely a testament to Corey Churko's recording prowess. But as a fellow singer, I'm listening to it from your standpoint, and you hit homers left at one after the other. To the point when I got to the Headpins song, and I didn't look at the liner notes or the notes on the track listing, and when you got to the second verse, I was like, how does Todd do that? How is he doing that? And then it was only I was like,
why is he doing that? He's going to hurt himself.
Yeah, I was like, that is amazing. and then I saw that Darby Mills is actually on the track.
Yeah, it's funny because we actually we've been doing like a lot of where Took sort of came from was just sort of we started doing some charity shows, breast cancer and a few things around Winnipeg. And Brent Fitz had the idea of like, let's just do all Canadian music. Wouldn't that be fun? And I was like, yeah, it'd be a blast. Then Winnipeg or, you know, places like that or Regina, I think we did one. And it was before it was even called Took. We were just kind of like, and we just sort of, you know, like Go for a Soda by Kim Mitchell and Tom Sawyer by Rush. And, you know, and then there would be fairly regional things as well. But you know, it's sort of the internationally or at least nationally well-known songs.
Right. Yeah.
And then it sort of went from there. I mean, to Corey's testament, things like that intro with the helicopters and all that laser stuff in Alda Nova, he built that. Like, he didn't just sort of use the track thing. He built that. He built the intro to the Lunatic Fringe by Red Rider. Like, he didn't sort of just use the thing. He basically reenacted the entire thing with the same tones of the same things, but largely it's sort of like he built that and played, you know, whatever needed to be played. So it's like to the point that you're like, it almost feels like largely unnecessary if it wasn't so impressive, you know. And then Darby's involvement just sort of came from us. You know, I would scream that song out at these charity shows just from years of doing AC/DC in clubs. It's kind of like you have this, oh yeah, there's this voice I can do. Right. And so, you know, it's like you don't want to do it every day. I don't know how Brian Johnson's made a career out of it, but God bless him. But then, you know, so I, you know, we went to record it and I was like, absolutely, let's do it. And then somewhere along the way, Corey got a hold of Darby and was like, you know, about something, I think something totally else. And then, hey, what would you think about singing, you know, on this? And she was like super cool about it. So she sang, into the third verse, she pops up third verse and third chorus. So
that's where it is. Yeah.
So it's kind of like, it's me screaming, you know, at the top of my lungs and as high as I can, because that's just, you know, cause she's screaming at the top of her lungs as high as she can. So I'm like kind of having to get there even harder, but there's that one, Toronto, which is Hollywood's female singer. And we'd also do Ironic by Alanis Morissette. So they got me singing three girl songs and I'm like, we did adjust the keys on Ironic by, I think, you know, like two frets. And I think the Toronto song is down a fourth or a fifth or something like that, just to kind of make it, you know, a little bit more like, doesn't sound ridiculous.
I noticed that you took on a lot of women's voices on this one. Yeah.
Well, it's a funny thing because, you know, you sing the way you sing, you know what I mean? No matter what you do with a gun to your head, you're going to sing the way you sing, you know what I mean? Mm-hmm. So when you're doing a version of whatever song it is, you're going to be singing it as you sing it, you know? So, and I think that's part of the interesting thing about doing these things that are, you know, because we've decided to wear this curator hat of like being Canadian ambassadors of our classic rock. Mm-hmm. It sort of makes you kind of go, you know, okay, well, I don't want, if these guys are going to be, you know, this close to the guitars, bass, drums, and keyboards, then I can't veer off too far on the vocals and suddenly be like, you know, well, this is how I would sing it. You know, you pretty much got to kind of do it the way it was sort of done with your own, you know, inflections in there as well.
Well, you know very well that when you finish a recording and you take it out live, the song as a vocalist will change. You'll change how you do it to the point where you've kind of forgotten the recording version. So when you brought Darby into the studio, was she wasn't going off her own recording. Was she like veering off? Because you guys are sticking so much to the script.
Yeah, I'm sure she's probably even doing her, like, you know, 2019 version of that song too. So, but I don't, you know, there was not really any direction per se. It was kind of like, just do what you do and let's not worry too much about like, oh, it's too different than the record. You know, it's kind of like, she's Darby Mills, but I mean, she can do whatever she wants.
Yeah. She's got one of the greatest rock voices ever.
Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, it's funny because I saw Headpins when I was a kid, saw them opening for Toronto, and it was like the record had just come out. It was a side project of Brian McLeod and Ab Bryant from Chilliwack. And I saw this version without Ab or Brian in the band because they were doing Chilliwack, obviously. And then years later, I saw them again with Ab and Brian, and Helix was opening. And that was my introduction to Helix. There's another band that we've overlooked.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
And an Eastern band again.
Yes, absolutely. Yeah, that would be Tuke EC.
There you go. And there's also, people keep saying, what about a Tuke heavy metal album? Helix, Anvil, you know, I'm like, oh man, that'd be pretty next level.
Yeah.
Killer Dwarfs.
yeah. Killer Dwarfs, Stand Tall.
Stand Tall. Exactly. Yeah.
Well, when we played Vegas in February, you guys were out on the road, but there was like a guy in the crowd who eventually I found out after the show is friends with you wearing a Headpins t-shirt. And I stopped the show in the middle between the songs, and I'm like, that, I gotta say, that Headpins shirt, man, what the hell, dude? And then
I know exactly who you're talking about now that I think about it. Yeah, of course, yeah.
And yeah, and then after we got to talking, I'm like, oh, of course it winds back to Todd Kearns. I mean, that makes sense.
That's the funny thing is, I mean, the joke is, you know, that there's nobody more Canadian than Canadians not living in Canada. You know, we suddenly are like here, and you go over to somebody's house, and it's like, hey, dude, check it out. And you go, yeah, that's April Wine. Okay, cool. You know, it's like they know I'm coming over, so they got to put on some, you know, it's like, you know, I also like the Rolling Stones. You know, it's like, you know, it's just this really, although my English friends are like that too. You go over to their place, and there's a picture of the Queen and Union Jacks, and you go, okay, dude, you get it. You're from England. You know, it's like, relax.
Yeah,
but it is very. Yeah. It is very, we do, our roots definitely are, you know, suddenly it's like Trailer Park Boys and everything Canadian, lots of hockey, you know, like, okay.
Yeah, every Tuesday we get all these Tim Hortons donuts flown in.
Oh, totally. Everybody's got the Tim Hortons coffee pods from Bed Bath & Beyond. For some reason they sell them there. It's totally weird, but they do.
Oh, wow.
I know, it's so weird. Like in the States, we all go to Bed Bath & Beyond. For Tim Hortons pods, it's the funniest thing. But yeah,
I love the record company you guys are part of, KTEL. Now, is it getting a hard copy treatment?
Yes. We have CDs of both records. It's it's what starts off as kind of a laugh, which is, you know, I think sometimes the best way to do almost anything is when it's not that it's not taken seriously, because obviously we take it very seriously as far as the you know, the recordings and the performances, but I don't think we ever really intended for it to be even what it is now, is sort of like beyond what I think anybody could have. But I mean, the weird thing is that I've known Corey since, you know, we're from Saskatchewan. So I've known him since we were teenagers. And I've known Fitz not long after that, and Shane not long after that, because we all played in this same Canadian prairies club scene for years. So it's weird to, it's once in a while, it's very unusual to be like, you know, to look over and go, yeah, that's Corey Churko. That's little Corey Churko. You know, the 14-year-old kid who could play, you know, Jump and Crazy Train, all the guitar solos that we were always like, damn, dude. You know, there was a time where, you know, we're shredding in the 80s. It seemed like, you know, 12-year-olds were like, you know, suddenly being able to shred. And you see it all the time now, but it's like back then it just seemed like all the guitar players I knew could play like that. Like it was like, you know, I was always in my Paul Stanley, Keith Richards mode over here. And they were doing their thing. And I was like, you know. And I'm still in my Paul Stanley, Keith Richards mode. Happily, comfortably.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. That's the best place to be.
It really is. I'm always kind of like, why are you guys working so hard?
Exactly. I mean, I don't do leads. I play rhythm. I play power chords. That's all I do.
I know. But I love what you do. It's, you know, you're from that same school as me where it's like, you know, it's like, it's, you know, if the A chord can punch you right in the face, that's all you need.
Yeah. I agree, but, you know, too.
I say that having someone like Corey Churko on the right playing the guitar solo from On the Loose by Saga. It's kind of like, well, someone, it's like even the idea of playing that Saga song never would have crossed my mind. I was like, of course, who doesn't love that song? But I'm like, I would be just kind of like, that's like a super grown-up song. Like, I can't play that.
Right. Well, that's also what's very impressive about the songs is the ones you chose weren't easy. I mean, you guys...
No.
Didn't take the easy way out. I mean, even Lunatic Fringe, if someone was to say, you guys got to cover Lunatic Fringe for this show we're doing on Saturday, I'd be like, well, how do we do this?
Yeah. I know. It's as if they all have this sort of, there's a sort of a, like a slightly progressive rock thing going on, like in bands like Street Hard and all that. Like there's, you know, it seems like they're pop songs, but then you're like, it's no joke going on when you kind of take a hard look at it. You're like, oh wow, these guys are not playing. So, you know, I think that says a lot about, there's a lot of attention to detail when it comes to Brent Fitz too. Like he is no joke when it suddenly comes in with like, actually this hi-hat pattern here is different. And you're like, oh, I would never notice that, you know, they all got their like, they've all got their magnifying glasses out. And I'm like, I'm just in there making a mess, like screaming at the top of my lungs and like, that's good, right? Let's move on.
Exactly. I'm checking my Instagram.
Exactly. It's more than enough to me.
Oh yeah. It's interesting though. I know Brent volleys back and forth between drums and bass and toque. Is it because he just wanted to play bass and be up front for a while?
I think it was kind of like one of those things where it was like this project started like it's that's the best word you can use is project because it's not a you know because it starts off as kind of like yeah let's just we're some Canadian guys let's just record some ideas on the first thing we did Shane wasn't really dialed in yet like Shane has been a part of a band called Bees in Japan for like 17 years and only like this last year has he sort of been back in LA. He always lived in LA, but he was spent most of his time in like Tokyo.
Amazing.
And like, and it's such a crazy chapter, right? For a guy from Innisfail, Alberta. But you know, through Yngwie Malmsteen and Michael Schenker, he's played with some crazy people and then just kind of found himself out there. But, so Fitz plays drums on the first album because it was basically just me, Corey, and Fitz.
Right.
And then Corey plays a lot of the instrumentation is Corey just in his lab. And then on the new record, it was a bit more Shane plays drums and Fitz plays bass. And I just think Fitz was kind of like, you know, because it's a fun project thing.
Yeah.
It wasn't really like, you know, and we also probably, without even really thinking about it, it's kind of bizarre when they go, when most people know us as the guys, the rhythm section for Slash, and it's suddenly like the bass player is the lead singer playing rhythm guitar and the drummer is the bass player. It's like totally rattles everybody's brain.
For Americans.
True. And for, like, well, and Europeans for that.
Yeah.
Matter, yeah.
I mean, when I see that, cause I've seen the video and everything,
it's totally normal.
Yeah, totally normal for me.
Anybody who really knows me just goes, oh, yeah.
Yeah. And that brings me to the single.
Go ahead.
Never Enough for You. In the true cover band, way, or just the process of being a cover band, eventually you're going to come out with an original song. Is that what was behind the thinking of putting out an original on a Took album?
Well, I think like everything else, that's actually the best, you know, the best way to put it is I think we just kind of like, well, you know what it's like as a musician. If you get together with some friends, eventually a riff is knocking around and eventually somebody puts a word to it. And the next thing you know, you got a song, you know, so, so in its own way, I think, you know, Corey and I just sort of started knocking around this idea and literally recorded the vocal at my house, and then finished it at his place kind of thing. So, you know, and then of course brought in the other guys to kind of finish it and sort of tighten it up and make it what it is. And it really specifically was sort of engineered to sound like a Took song. Cause I felt like, you know, we had kind of created this project with these keyboards and with this, you know, specific kind of guitar playing and this whole vibe of the thing. And I thought, well, it'd be really weird for us to sit down and make this sort of, you know, like we're going to make a, you know, a feel good alternative kind of, you know what I mean? Like a, like something totally like left field in the middle of the record would just be weird. So we specifically sort of engineered it to sound like the other songs on the record to some degree,
right?
At least production wise, you know what I mean? So that's why there's the keyboards are big and the guitars were really, you know, really, really huge. And it sort of, it was really fun to kind of like pick that side of your brain. Cause there's a thing that I do, you know, we all have our thing. We reach into our pocket or our, you know, our little, our bag of tricks. We have those tricks we do. And you don't even really realize that you have them until you're kind of like, until you do that. And then one day you kind of go, what would it, you know, it'd be fun. I mean, I think about it sometimes, like how much fun would it be to go, I'm going to make an entire record and we're going to use Simmons drums and 80s synthesizers. You know, like the challenge of doing that would be probably really satisfying. And it would probably be like one record. You'd be like, well, that was fun. Let's go back to what I normally do. But if you challenge yourself in that way to do that, it would, you know, it would totally open up another side of your brain. So in doing this, it was sort of more of a throwback to, we always think of the Canadian bands that we grew up on. We're always a five piece band, bass, drums, guitar, keyboards, and a vocalist. It was always the same sort of setup from almost like probably 10 bands from Loverboy to Streetheart to Haywire to, Honeymoon Suite to, there's just an endless number of the ones of that I can list that it's just kind of all that lineup. And so we kind of engineered Never Enough for You to be kind of that, you know, without even really, without a sort of a mandate or a manifesto as to how that's supposed to go. It just sort of went that way. You know, it's like Corey went crazy on the keyboards and I was like, damn, dude. Okay, here we go. Let's do it.
I found myself humming the tune and then going, what band are they covering on that? And I was trying to remember which band it was. And then I was like, oh, no, that's the original. So it does stick with the vibe of
the familiarity to some degree. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. That's what it is.
Yeah.
Not like, necessarily.
Maybe it could have been on the radio in 1989 or something.
Exactly. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And I have to be honest with you, your version of Ironic, I like better than the original. Not that I was a big fan of the original to begin with, but hearing you sing it was great. Really?
Oh, thank you.
Yeah, it was really, really good. Really refreshing.
It was funny because that one, that just sort of came as a, maybe some bit of a challenge. I can't remember where it really came from, but it was not really an obvious choice for us, but it was just sort of like, I think it was some sort of like specific, like as a friend of mine brought up the other day, he goes, you were particularly, you know, the entire catalog of these records is between this year and this year. And it was like a 5-year period. And it was very interesting to go like, well, that's when we would have been teenagers growing up on Canadian rock, was this particular chapter of Canadian rock. And I think somebody brought up the idea of it being sort of male centric and and also very sort of, I'm like, yeah, well, we were guys growing up in the prairies listening to rock and roll. So this is what we played. And I think that the Alanis song came up, and it's the kind of thing that people always do that. They, you know, to me without either of us being aware of it, is they just plant a little mind bomb that kind of goes off later on, you know, where I think about like, you know, what would a version of, you know, Ironic by, you know, Alanis Morissette sound like as done by Took? And I'm like, oh, that's ridiculous. And then like a week later, I'm sitting there going like, it's pretty cool, actually. You know, it's like, next thing you know, you're like, you know what we should do? We should do a version of, and then, you know, off we go. And Corey's really good about even like being kind of like I know in his initial response is like, absolutely not. But then I think he's kind of like me in the sense that he kind of has that feeling of like, but what would that sound like? And that could be really cool, you know? And the next thing you know, it is, it's a great, I mean, you got to hand it to Alanis, man. That album was fucking massive, you know? And I was in a weird way at Ground Zero when that all went down, because I was touring. Age of Electric was opening for Sass Jordan back then. And the drummer was Taylor Hawkins, who's now in the Foo Fighters. But he and the guitar player Nick Lashley were, after that tour, going to play with Alanis. And I was like, you mean Alanis the pop singer? Because at the time she was a pop singer in Canada. Yeah. And they're like, no, she's got this cool alternative thing. And I remember thinking kind of like, what? You know, that doesn't sound like, that doesn't sound like that's going to work on paper. And of course, like, you know, by that time, 6 months later, it was the biggest album in the, you know, in the world.
Yeah.
So, you know, I mean, it says something to kind of like change your perspective once in a while as a, like I say, a male, the music that I gravitate towards, the music that I like, the music that sort of natural to me. Every once in a while you go, but girls love this. Let's, you know, and I've always been really good about, people are always like, why do you know so much about The Cure and Depeche Mode and Duran Duran? And I go, because girls like those bands, dude. Girls like those bands. When I was a kid, it was kind of like, you know, oh, you know, this girl I have a crush on really likes The Cure. And I would find myself like, you know, studying it like, you know, like a class I needed to ace. Like, yeah, you're right. This album is better than that album, you know, and like all these different bands like that. And I was always very aware that, you know, girls dig this kind of music. And it wasn't like some sort of like Machiavellian plan. It was just sort of like, you know, I really kind of couldn't help but gravitate toward. I mean, Platinum Blonde was our equivalent in Canada. When I would go to those concerts as a kid, it was like just screaming girls like a Beatlemania.
Oh my God. Yeah.
Situation. And, you know, now I know those guys as, you know, as friends, and it's really fascinating to witness it. But I mean, you know, that's why we covered Crying Over You on the first album, is because, you know, that had an impact on us as kids. You know, like those guys were like, you know, my first experience with like, whoa, you know, these are like crying girls and the whole thing, like at least my own firsthand experience at it.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. I mean, back in Toronto here, Mark Holmes, he co-owns the Mod Club, I think.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So when we played the Mod Club at the end of the show, I go, I heard Mark Holmes owns this place. Could you please sign my record? I brought out my record.
I love it.
But
I saw them open for Platinum for Bryan Adams, and I'd never heard of Platinum Blonde. And they were a 3-piece band, and they looked bitchin', and the songs were catchy. We didn't know who they were, and it was right when like I'd seen Bryan Adams open up for Loverboy in like '83. I was a kid, but Bryan was on fire. Like, he came out and just like was running around, and I was like, "Who's this guy? Wow!" And then years later, I go to see Bryan Adams. And it's a lot more ballad centric in a in a way, you know. Right, it was like that's not a slight against him. He had these great ballad, Heaven, and all those songs were huge, you know. And then this band Platinum Blonde was opening for him, and there was a similar experience of like, well, these guys, he's huge, but who are these guys? Like, they're cool and they look great, and their songs are really catchy. And there was a slightly Police thing about them, but kind of glammy in a way.
Yeah.
And so, you know, and then like the next time I saw them, they were like the Beatlemania moment. So it's funny how all these things, you know, to me are connected, you know, because I am hugely well versed in the hardest and heaviest of rock. And then, but I'm very aware of the other side. And that was because of girls. Frankly, if I may be honest.
Yeah, we could all say it now, I guess, right?
Yeah, well, it's, you know, it's kind of like, you know, it was like, how can you be listening to, you know, like, at the time it would have been like, you know, Van Halen and AC/DC, and then like at the same time Duran Duran. It was kind of like your friends would be like, what? I go, I'm sorry, dude. You know, some girl from school really loves Duran Duran, and this song's pretty damn catchy, you know. So it's just sort of the nature of being able to kind of. And I think a lot of that has benefited me to try and be as open-minded about music in general. You know, there's a lot of stuff that comes out that I go, this isn't for me, but this is a catchy fucking song. You know?
Yeah. Yeah. I think I think very similarly, but I wish you had told me this.
Yeah.
Yeah, I wish you had told me this back when I was in school, because my KISS t-shirt with my KISS pins on my baseball trucker hat and my Motley Crue pins all over my trucker hat, it just wasn't working.
Right. Well, yeah, exactly. Because girls, you know, we'd always laugh at that, because it was like, you know, you would notice the difference immediately when you would go to like a Metallica concert. It was all dudes.
Yeah.
And then you'd go to like, I don't know, take your pick of something else. Even a Def Leppard or Bon Jovi concert is like, sure, suddenly like infinitely more females. You're like, oh, wow, okay.
Yeah.
But, you know, it's like, it's up to you, whatever you're into. But yeah, I don't know if I was the same way, though. I was still running around with, you know, KISS t-shirts and whatever else, and very dude-centric stuff. Well, I just happened to kind of be pretty good at going like, you're right. It'd be the same as me trying to like, you know, study Shakespeare or something like that, just to kind of appear, you know, somewhat kind of more, spirit, you know, culturally open to the ladies. But it none of that really works anyway. You know, it's kind of like, you eventually learn that it's like, I guess you just be yourself.
Yeah, you'll be found out eventually.
Yeah, exactly. They'll call you out eventually.
But someone should have just tapped me on the shoulder and said, hey, dude, the trucker hat with the Gene Simmons pin with his tongue sticking out, it's not going to get the girls.
Right.
The girls you want. You know,
it may have in 1977 or 78. Oh.
You know, I'm sure, like, Gene, it would have worked for Gene, but not
exactly
some 11-year-old kid.
Yeah, maybe not. But that doesn't matter, right? So, you know, you look at the path it sets you on.
Yeah,
we're
exactly.
We're both on that same path. I'm about to go and do the KISS cruise next month, and I'm playing, it's like with Bruce Kulick, and we're doing all non-makeup era KISS. And it's a specific, you cannot lose on the KISS cruise, because it's the Star Trek convention of KISS fans. So the deeper you dig, the more response you get. You know, it's like, it's almost a challenge now. It's like, oh, you like that, did you? Well, check this out, you know?
Yeah.
So we really try to, you know, we really try and dig deep. It's really been that you would really enjoy that. I can't believe next time I'm going to put your name in the list. Get the Danko Jones Band up there to play on the cruise. It'd be great.
Well, you know, I would definitely be a kid in a candy store for that cruise.
Yes, you would. And bring your records.
Oh yeah. Well, I've been working on for years, a jean jacket with only non-makeup patches. And once I get enough to fill it, I want someone who's like from another planet, if they were to see my jean jacket, they would never know KISS wore makeup.
Right.
I have a lot of patches, and I just need like five or six more and it'll be completely covered.
Well, there's a lot of people and I've learned over the years, because I'm, you know, I when I was a little kid, when I think about it, like by the time, you know, KISS had taken the makeup off, we were still fairly young, but I was, you know, it was like everything to us. I own the KISS pinball machine in my living room. It's like just, it's who I am, you know?
Oh my God.
But yeah, oh, dude, yeah, it's like a whole other thing. It's like one of the prized possessions. But the, you know, the idea of like, I've met so many people who came into KISS like from Lick It Up on, like they kind of, of course, went backwards and found the old material, but their whole, like even Chris Jericho, the wrestler, his whole thing is like Lick It Up to, you know, Revenge or whatever, like that sort of non-makeup period. And I don't blame him. I play that with Bruce all the time, and it's all killer music that's largely overlooked now by the band, because the band is, you know, focusing on a much bigger catalog, obviously.
Well, in the 40 years of KISS, the 13 years of non-makeup will, as time goes on, be like the era that I think is the most special, because, you know, it was only the small, as more time goes on, it was only the small time they weren't wearing the makeup.
Totally.
So I love Lick It Up is in my top three albums of the KISS discography.
I can't argue with you there, dude. It's like, yeah, that's a killer record.
Yeah. Yeah.
So, I mean, like when we do the cruise, it's like literally like they don't, I mean, they've obviously, they're KISS fans. They are rock and roll all night and out.
Mm-hmm.
They're Detroit Rock City'd out, shout it out, laugh it out, you know. So when you bust out Turn On the Night from Crazy Nights, they go fucking bananas. Yes, I never would have thought so, because it's kind of like, you know, I was just kind of like, yeah, of course, this is from Bruce's catalog. But people, my wife was saying that there are literally people in tears when we do I Still Love You from Creatures of the Night and stuff like that. It's like, you know, people are really, you know, you're playing music that they never think that they're going to hear live again, because it's not in their wheelhouse. But when guys like you, you know, Lick It Up, and which other ones would you put in that list?
In terms of a set list, or
Well, I mean, just like of your favorites of the non-makeup era. Or even favorites of the catalog. I mean, the Kiss catalog. If Lick It Up is in the top three, that says a lot.
Oh, it's funny because I just did a debate with Daniel Decay.
I heard this, yeah.
Yeah, about Destroyer, but yesterday we recorded...
Destroyer versus Slick It Up? Is that what it was?
No, it was like, I don't like Destroyer, he loves Destroyer.
Sure,
and
sure,
so yeah. We did a reverse yesterday, we did, which will be posted later. I love Love Gun, he doesn't like Love Gun.
How can you not like... I mean, that's... whatever.
Yeah, exactly.
It's so funny because I have long conversations of this just yesterday about Destroyer versus... like Love Gun or like Rock and Roll or Dress to Kill, because I kind of veer towards the raw, you know, the raw records, yeah, where man. Destroyer is just too lush for me. There's too much going on. I'm like, there's a great shit on that record, but it's just not, it's not my... well, when I think of Kiss, I don't think of Destroyer. I think of, like, say Rock and Roll Over is sort of like, in a lot of ways, sort of the quintessential sound of that band. You know, but, just sort of like guitars and drums and catchy tunes, you know. It's I wouldn't say Rock and Roll Over is my favorite. In fact, I make big arguments for the very first album now. A lot of my friends are like, but it doesn't sound good. I go, yeah, but dude, like 90% of that record is material that could be played in their set list today. Deuce, Strutter, yeah, Firehouse, Cold Gin, 100,000 Years, Black Diamond, like that's six songs right there. And I know I'm missing one or two. Like the whole record is like almost all classic songs, you know, which is... and it's like Kissin' Time and like
Love Theme.
Well, I know what I'm missing on that is the Nothing to Lose is on that record. Is Nothing to Lose on that record? Yeah, I think it is.
They still play that live, or
I don't know if they still play it live, but they're the kind of songs that they can rotate in and out of the set list that, you know, that still kind of work, you know what I mean? And you know, but that's an endless conversation. It's funny how, like, I was saying the other day how you can, like, find something to argue about. It's like we can work our way down to being the Beatles is the best band alive, and then have an argument about why Paul McCartney is better than John Lennon. You know what I mean? Like, it's the funniest thing how we can do that. And like you say, it's like, no, Love Gun's better than Destroyer, and off we go.
Yeah. Well, I mean, in terms of the non-makeup, it's Lick It Up, Animalize, and Asylum for me. Those are the ones that I loved.
Animalize was the first time I ever saw Kiss, and Bruce was the guitar player. So I was a kid at a hockey arena watching Kiss for the very first time, you know, and when they said, you wanted the best, you got the best, the hottest band in the world, Kiss, it was like, you know, it was life-changing, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
And it was non-makeup Kiss, and now all these years later, I you know, I go to Bruce's house. And, yeah,
it's amazing.
And I'm like, that's the guy that I, you know, stood there and went, you know, that's the new guitar player. You know?
So it's, how'd you hook up with Bruce?
Well, Brent used to play in Union with Bruce. After Bruce left Kiss,
yeah,
he put together Union with John Corabi from Motley Crue.
Right, I remember that band.
Yeah, they did a few records, and then Brent was just new to L.A., and they were like, you know, let's just get this kid to play drums, probably because you really don't have to pay him very much. Joke's on him. But yeah, all these years later, it's sort of like, you know, Brent and Bruce and I have always sort of found a way to kind of jam together, and you know, and when it comes to this kind of thing, like in the same way that we're curators of Canadian music, suddenly I find myself being part of the curator of of this non-makeup Kiss chapter, which is so important to these people and to all of us, you know what I mean? But it's Bruce is the only guy waving that flag, you know, he's the last of those Mohicans.
Yeah,
you know,
it's really interesting
because the other guy, Eric Singer, is in the makeup version of Kiss now, so it's sort of like, it's like he's the only guy. And it's funny because Paul Stanley's reaction is kind of like, it has been nothing but positive. He's sort of like, man, it's so cool to hear like these songs that, you know, that we, he said to Bruce something like, you know, it's just so great to see, you know, all these songs that we came up with back then and to hear them. And, you know, it's even a trip for him. And I'm like, wow, that means everything. You know, that's right there from the guy. You're like, wow, that's a trip.
Oh man, I'm Team Paul.
I've always been Team Paul.
He's my man. Yeah. He's my man too, man. Whoa. Yeah. He replied to my tweet. Whoa. I got to frame it. It's one of my projects I got to do.
He replied to your tweet?
Yeah.
What did he say? What tweet? What was the tweet?
He posted a photo of himself with his hand to his ear, and he said, like, questions or something. He threw out, like, he's open for questions. And I just logged on to Twitter at that moment. So I got in there, and I asked him about his painting. Is he going to do a show? Or have them, you know, prints or something like about his paintings. And then he replied saying, I've got to paint a lot more. Yes, I'm in with Paul.
That's a trip, dude. That's a trip. Yeah, dude, I've like on the boat, all that stuff's there. The paintings, everything. It's like
amazing.
It's just a full nerd experience, you know, and I'm just kind of like a kid in a candy store. It's like, you know, it's still the one band. I mean, obviously I have several bands that I'm really passionate about, but you know, Kiss as Brian Posehn, I think, was the comedian who said, if they found you at the right age, they had you for life, you know? And I think I was the perfect age, you know,
when
you're like that young and it's just like, boom, you got me.
I joined the army when I was 6.
Damn. Okay. So yeah, you were young. Yeah. Love it. And you're still a part of the army.
Yeah. I mean, I look from afar with a nice wistful smile.
Of course. Yeah. I think we kind of all do. And you know, it's like, I mean, I have a feeling that Kiss will carry on long after anyway. Like when we're grandparents, it's going to be, you know, your grandkids are going to see, or your you know, great nephews or whatever timeline unfolds before you. And they go, we're going to go see Kiss tonight. You're going to be like, Kiss? this third generation of like young guys dressed up as Kiss, you know, like Gene and Paul will be, you know, old men or whatever, you know. But I guarantee you that's bound to happen.
Well, yeah, like... it's probably because, you know, I've spent so much time behind the curtains in the music industry. So you kind of know the inner workings of things.
Totally.
And it's not as magical as it used to be for me. So yeah, there's things where I've just not anything to do with Kiss, but just like overall, I've just kind of, all right. I still love the music. So.
Well, it's the same as everything else. It's seeing behind the curtain on the Wizard of Oz, you know, eventually. I get it. You know, it's like when my friends are like, can you believe this band? You know, when people leave bands and there's always this kind of thing of like the drama of like, I hate that band now because this guy left. And I'm like, I go, dude, do you know how hard it is to keep a band together? You know, how hard it is to keep a marriage together? It's like, then try doing it with three other people or four other people. It's like, it's just tough. And when that band becomes a much larger entity that you're trying to keep afloat, and someone's behavior is causing damage to that entity. I mean, I hate you know, because I don't really think that way. I don't think of the music that I've made or the bands that I've been in. Probably the reason why I haven't been in something for 25 years or 30 years, because, you know, we sort of were more that artistic kind of hat on all the time. But the idea of like, you know, your band or brand, if you want to call it, being negatively affected, then you would have to make some changes to make sure it keeps going forward, especially when it's like, you know, something as colossal as Kiss was in the time that they had to make those changes initially, you know, because of, you know, it is what it was, you know. And we can have this conversation all day long. Well, technically that's what I always liken it to comic book and sci-fi nerdery, because there's few bands that you can talk about with as much passion and knowledge about like so many different things about. It feels like you're talking about Star Trek or Star Wars or something sometimes. Like, well, technically, you know, and then you get these guys with really strong opinions about, you know, and you're always like, dude, it's a band. Let's all relax and enjoy the music.
I mean, I take it with a tongue in cheek, you know, when people put down Kiss in front of me to see if they'll, you know, get me. I laugh alongside them. You know, you're not going to get me on whether or not you like Kiss, you know.
But isn't that part of the charm? I mean, like, I say this all the time. It's kind of like, you know, like, I've never really ever felt bad about the fact that I can't play, like super progressive music. It's because, like, I just never really, it never grabbed me. What grabbed me was bands like Kiss and the Dolls and Cheap Trick and all that kind of stuff. And if somebody didn't like it, especially when it comes to Kiss, because nothing could be more polarizing at certain points than Kiss, it was always kind of like, well, that's our thing. You know what I mean? It's like, it's not meant for everybody.
Yeah.
And that's part of the charm of all that kind of stuff. It's kind of like saying, but I say that with music in general. Music is kind of like restaurants. It's kind of like, if you don't like seafood, then you're probably not going to like this band. And what are you supposed to do? Like, change your entire, like, is some seafood restaurant supposed to change its entire game because the, you know, X amount of people don't like seafood? No, yeah. They're going to do their thing. That's just the way it goes, you know?
Yeah, that's a great analogy.
Yeah, it's just sort of like, you know, and I always felt like, you know, you sure you can meet lots of people who don't like the music you like, but you can always find people who do. And nothing binds us quicker than people who share a taste in music. I mean, I speak for myself, but I'm sure you're the same way. Most of the friends I made as a young man or as a kid was all based on, like, we like the same music.
Oh, yeah.
And movies and whatever as well, but I mean, but largely music. And that's still the way it is today. Like I say, I'm still surrounded by guys where we sit down, have a coffee, we're talking about this and that, and the next thing you know, we're talking about, you know, Love Gun versus Destroyer, you know, or whatever, you know, or something along those lines, you know.
Oh, I love it. I love arguing about whatever band, Kiss or whatever,
sure.
Especially Kiss, you know, it's so much fun to do so, you know. And
totally, yeah.
Whether you agree or argue, I love it.
And there's very few bands you can really, you know, really get into that with, because I don't know. I mean, I guess you could sit around and argue about, you know, Brian Jones era versus Mick Taylor era versus Ronnie Wood era of the Rolling Stones or whatever you want to do. But I don't find that conversation happens as much in that. It's kind of like, you know, yeah, the Stones are great. You know, we all love the Stones, and we kind of move on to the next subject.
It's like, it's true.
It's like, Tom Petty's awesome. Okay, let's move on. You know, it's like no one really sort of wants to, you know. But people get passionate about, like, Kiss was fucking this era, and I don't want to hear anything else about it. You know, it's like, okay.
I think it's because they made so many missteps as much as they had success.
Sure.
So it endeared them to us. It made them
sure.
More human, you know, where
and even if the missteps, if you still, because there's been a couple of times where I've enjoyed their missteps, you know, like yeah. What they consider missteps, you know, I was there. I was listening to The Elder full volume going like, this is great. A lot of my friends going, what the hell are you talking about? But it's kind of like, that's the nature of being a fan, is you're kind of like when my friends start saying, oh, I fell off at Unmasked, or I fell off in here, I fell off there. And I kind of like, I think I was just of that age and that mindset of like, there's a new Kiss record out. We go out and we buy it and we listen to it all the time. And it's our favorite new record. And
yeah.
then the next year there's a new one and we put that on and it replaces, you know, I mean, it's sort of the nature of it. And I think that just sort of worked that way until I was old enough to kind of, you know, make my own decisions, I guess.
We've
gone way off course, Dan.
It's true. I mean, I could talk about Kiss for another 5 hours with you.
That's a different.
Because this is awesome. But going back to Took, and I'll let you go real soon. There is, out of the two albums, there is one track that I'm not very familiar with, which is the Orphan track. Lonely okay. at Night. Who are Orphan? I don't know that band.
That is a very, that's very specifically, they're a band from Winnipeg. And it's a funny story because when I was telling you before about chasing Alex Chowacki, the lead singer for the Queen City Kids down the street.
Right.
Because they were playing at a club called the A4. And when I was like, I don't know, 14 maybe, we snuck into that bar. And the first band I ever saw in a bar was called Orphan. And I remember it being like a huge deal, like, because they were like, you know, they had been the Pumps before that, who also had a record out, which is kind of worth chasing down as well. And they became Orphan, and it's another one of those ones that got away. Like I later on saw them opening for Platinum Blonde in the Beatlemania phase of Platinum Blonde.
Right.
And we loved them. We thought they were really cool. They were a four-piece band. The bass player was the singer. They had a keyboard player and a guitar player and a drummer. And it was just really great songs, really smart, cleverly written songs. And they just never really kind of got out from, I guess, Western Canada. Because it's very specifically one of those bands that I think was really endearing to us, and if you were around for that year, you know, that's how, you know, their moment was sort of like, you know, in that maybe like 3-year period where, you know, like bands like that were really important to us. And of course we still know those guys, and we know them now, you know, and, yeah, so they were from Winnipeg, and they definitely had a very cool thing. And then they, to Winnipeg people, there's a cool thing about Winnipeg, because I was from Saskatchewan, and we would play Saskatchewan, we would play Alberta, Saskatchewan, Alberta, Saskatchewan, Alberta. We'd kill ourselves in this whole club circuit they had out there. And it was just so common and so many bands that it was almost kind of like you could just do all that undetected. Like there wasn't really a scene or like a... or at least in the cover scene. I mean, I'm sure there was a punk scene, and they really supported their bands and whatnot. But then all of a sudden, one day we went out to Winnipeg. We played one show, and suddenly there was a write-up about us in the paper. We were like, wow, this is crazy. And we really came to learn that Winnipeg had its own little infrastructure of its own music and support system of artists that they really support. So a lot of bands like Streetheart and Queen City Kids all basically ended up making Winnipeg their home because it had so much more of a scene there for some reason.
Right.
And it still kind of does in its own way. Like it's weird when I go to Winnipeg, it's like there's always something going on. Like there's a whole art scene going on there and stuff like that I wasn't aware of it where I came from. So, I mean, very well it probably existed, but I don't think I was just aware of it. So it seemed like Saskatchewan, Alberta was a lot more like, you know, it was just sort of, still kind of figuring it out at the time. Yeah. Calgary certainly has a way more of an art scene now, but it seemed like Winnipeg had its own thing going on. And I think that that's why bands like that could kind of flourish. And I think that sometimes they made the mistake of probably staying. And the one thing I've learned about places like Winnipeg is that my friends who grew up there, they stay there. And it's kind of like, you know, cause it's a great town. It's freezing, but it's a great town. It's got its own thing going on and there's really no reason to leave. But I think that the big challenge for anybody, including Age of Electric, we went to Vancouver. We very well could have gone to Toronto or Los Angeles or New York or whatever you do, you know.
Right.
But it really, at some point, you kind of have to kind of make that move. I mean, trust me, I always look back and go, like, if things had gone well enough, like in a Nickelback way where you were huge and you could still call Vancouver home, then I would still be there. But for me, it just sort of, you know, it turned into all these opportunities in the U.S. that led me here. But I mean, if you could have a international career and still live in Winnipeg or Regina, Saskatchewan, hell yeah, none of us would ever leave. But
not only that, but you'd be like king of the city.
Yeah, probably right. And that's probably true of like, you know, what Burton Cummings is, you know, when he's living in Winnipeg or something like that. It's like that's got to be like. I can't imagine what that's like. It's got to be like, you know, you basically like get the keys to the city or something.
Yeah, yeah. It's like, so how much do I owe you for this Big Mac and fries? No, it's yours. Bye.
Thank you, Mr. Cummings. Yeah, I know. It's kind of like, I always think that because I go, Burton lives here in Winnipeg? That's, you know, it's kind of like, that'd be like Paul McCartney, like just deciding to go back to Liverpool.
Right. Yeah. It's true. Yeah,
like anything you want, Mr. McCartney. Park wherever you want. He's, you know, just leave his car in the middle of the road and just gonna walk away.
Well, for years I'd heard your path. Like I'd heard that, you know, yeah. Todd Kearns went to Vegas, and yeah. Todd Kearns is playing with the dudes in Faster Pussycat, and no details. Just that I knew that you were like killing it. Down in Vegas and LA kind of area. And you know, me as a Canadian kid and just touring in a van, I was like, yeah, that totally makes sense that he would like get out of here, man. You know, and he's going to kill it down there.
Well, I think it was also a thing of like, you know, because I came from the prairies, you know, I sort of left very quickly because, you know, the call started, you know, okay, well, let's go play on the road. And sort of like, even though I still had roots and would float in and out of Saskatchewan, it was sort of like, you know, I was immediately kind of traveling, you know, and it was in I eventually put down roots in Calgary briefly and eventually made my way to Vancouver. And so it was pretty normal to me to kind of like, you know, to pick up and go. And it's kind of healthy actually sometimes because you get so comfortable wherever you are, but I'm not like you where I'm not exactly sure where you grew up, but I assume you grew up in the Toronto area, didn't you?
Yeah.
So, I mean, like growing up in a place like that, where it's kind of like, it's kind of all there. You know what I mean? So like for me, it was like, I always say, like, when you're in Saskatchewan, Toronto just seems like another planet. You know what I mean? So Los Angeles and all that, that sounds like Krypton or Tatooine. It sounds like, you know, made up places. You know, you're never going to go there, you know, and then Tokyo, that's not even a thing.
Right.
You know?
Yeah.
It's just all insane. So, but you know, it's like slowly as you kind of like, as I kind of started to, yeah, it's basically a thing of like, you kind of had to put myself where the opportunities were just going to be a little more. In a lot of ways, I probably never would have left Vancouver because I still love it there. And you know, I just had a lot of, you know, such great experiences there and whatnot. But, you know, I think that that's sort of, you know, but I really love, I mean, like I said to you earlier, I went to see Donnie and Marie last night in Las Vegas. And I thought, as I was sitting there watching this, and I just looked in and I just thought, and where else would I be doing this? You know, I was like, it's a totally I was like, that's the one thing about Vegas is it just kind of happens to be like, it's Wednesday night or Thursday night or whatever it is. And it's like, what do you want to do? Hey, Donnie Marie's down there. Let's call so-and-so. And the next thing you know, I'm sitting there watching Donnie Marie like, this is so surreal, you know. And that's the cool thing about Vegas is it's like, I basically live in a small town and the strip is like 50 minutes that way. You know, it's like the most insane place on the planet is just over there. Right. And all the best restaurants and all the best shows and everything is in this town. But I kind of live a very quiet life, and Los Angeles is a few hours drive, so it's kind of like the reason I'm here is, you know, I've really grown to really be attached to this particular corner of the world.
Well, I mean, Todd, this has been great chatting up about Tuke and catching up with you and talking about Canadian rock. It's something I don't get to do very much.
Well, you know, like I say, it's like, you know, it's one of those things that I'm really proud, you know, that, you know, guys like you and I can say we grew up with the very, I would assume growing up in Sweden, you know, as well as I do, like that scene over there or, you know, wherever they have bands in all of, you know, in all these different places that they grew up with, that they are really particular to and that really influenced them. And that's kind of like, we don't know anything about those bands in the same way that the rest of the world may not know a lot about some of the music you and I grew up on because it's so specific to where we grew up. So, you know, we really are, I mean, it's not some corny like tagline. We really are like, you know, we really love this music, and that's why we initially did it, was because, you know, it was like, wouldn't it be cool if somebody in Brazil said, I love this song by Orphan, you know, you're like, wow. Cause nobody, my friends that are from Canada don't know what Orphan is, you know? So it's like, so it's a very, you know, that's the most rewarding part of it.
I think the takeaway from the Tuke band for me is it kind of brands it as a thing, like Canadian rock at this certain era of Canadian rock is a club. We all, there's a certain group of people,
it kinda is,
who know and love it, and it's great to be part of this kind of club that you guys have kind of started or branded. With Tuke.
Yeah, I mean, we certainly didn't start it. We just kind of like drew attention to it, I suppose.
Well, yeah, like you kind of, I don't know, codified it or branded it in a way where it's like, this is a thing. And I love it.
I mean, who knows what'll, I mean, there very likely will probably come a day where suddenly like there's a Tuke record that's like maybe a couple covers and a bunch of our songs. And then next thing you know, doing its own thing. I don't know. It's really hard to talk about like, tomorrow, let alone next year, or you know what I'm saying, just because of the nature of life. But you know, there may come a day where it was kind of like, you know, Tuke started as this and then now it's this. So as it stands right now, it's like, you know, we just recently played like with 5440 and Styx, and it was kind of like, and we slam dunk because you go out there with this really stacked deck, you know. It's like your set list is like all these songs that people love, period. You know, it's like the best song, Raise a Little Hell by Trooper, you can't go wrong. You know, it's like all these songs that just kind of, that they love every single song. It's just, you know.
Was this in Edmonton?
That was in Regina and Calgary.
Because did Gowan play A Criminal Mind?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Every time in Canada, he plays Criminal Mind. So that's another Canadian that, you know, right away we get into that with him, like, you know, talking about, you know, all the songs. Cause you know, they heard us playing, like, you know, had to get caught up on all the Canadian stuff, you know?
Yeah. We just played with Styx this past summer. So we were able to talk to Larry and he came around, and it's great.
He's such a good dude.
Yeah, it's and again with Tuuk and watching Larry Gowan in Styx, it kind of fills you up with pride a little bit, you know? Like I'm like, wow, that's you guys don't know who that guy is, man.
Oh, I know. Yeah, it's one of the classic Canadianisms about being down here is it drives all my American friends crazy. Like, yeah, I know Jim Carrey's Canadian. Shut the fuck up. Because no matter what you're doing, you can't help but sit there and be going like, you know, yeah. Well, yeah, you know, it's a great movie. It's got Ryan Gosling, Canadian, Ryan Reynolds, Canadian. I'm just like, you just drop it like it's just you can't help it. It's like you're constantly, because, dude, I know they're Canadian. Can we just move on? Yeah. I just like to out, you know, like, you know, he's Canadian.
Yeah, yeah, right. Yeah. No, it was great meeting Gowan in Sweden. So once again, it's two Canadians meeting
somewhere
else. Was that
Sweden Rock?
It was Sweden Rock. And he was sitting in their shuttle van. And it was raining and, you know, no one was in a good mood. Everyone was just like, I can't believe it's raining outside. And I went up to him and I name dropped a couple of mutual friends of ours. And he just perked up and it was great. And then, of course, the rain stopped and everyone was happy again. And they killed it.
Oh, I bet. Yeah, they're a great band. I mean, you kind of forget. You know, not really forget. I don't think that's the right word. But you just go, of course, yeah, it sticks. And then you can see them playing. You're like, oh, wow, these guys are no joke.
Yeah. Yeah, but it is cool to see Larry Gowan fronting Styx.
Oh, 100%. Yeah. I mean, he's more than qualified, beyond qualified. Yeah.
Well, Todd, thanks a lot for doing this, man.
Thank you, brother. Thank you so much. Always a blast.
Always great talking to you. And I know it's like early afternoon for you, so I'm going to let you go and enjoy the rest of the day.
Yes, you too. Take care.
Yeah. All right, man.
Okay.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Bye.